but just the variation that is introduced by having this arch not quite as wide in span and not quite as high. Actually, it's really even a little bit flatter on this side. And then look at the lovely way in which he handles the groining. That is to say, these members on the inside of the vault. And the way in which he lays his stone in there. It's a very, very fine and very sensitive way of handling it. And if you look at, from about where I'm standing here, if you look up at the sweep of this tower, how he has utilized every single line in the structure, even on the backside of it, in order to get the kind of image, the kind of picture that he wants. It's a real upsweep. Again, I think somebody probably with a little lesser skill would have not bothered to put this room on the side here and would have concentrated on the tower. But it's this room which gives you your sweeping curve. It's these little things that are the difference between a genuinely skillful architect and somebody who is merely competent. You'll notice, too, such little things as a difference in the design of the ornament on the downspout, there and over there. We'll see some different ones as we go along, just to keep it from being too much of the same thing all the time. The breaking of this wall with this breakout here of this little bay window, again, keeps the wall from being a dead thing and adds life and vitality to it.
Would you say that the treatment of I don't know if you'd call that a gargoyle or not.
No, they're not. Those are just water spouts. Gargoyles are not characteristic of this type of architecture. They're primarily a French tradition. I don't think you'll find any gargoyles. Gargoyles are the rather fanciful heads of mythological beasts that are worked. You'll see this especially in the French Gothic cathedrals. With which these downspouts are worked out. You have this kind of thing. It's on the outside of the church. It's to suggest that outside of the church you have the diabolic or the demonic. It is in the up in the air, the prince of the powers of the air, and this kind of thing plays a role in there. But the English never did it very much. The English had their own little way of handling their jokes. The gargoyles are very frequently jokes, sometimes kind of bitter ones. But the English, you find this elsewhere too, had them in the misery cards. You were expected, of course, to stand to the divine office. And when this was sung, and you happened to have, say, mountains plus large plus prime, you got just a little bit weary. So that you didn't have really a seat, but you had a little piece built out against which you could rest yourself and still maintain a relatively standing position. And on the underside of these little misery cords, from the Latin word misericordia, the architect had mercy on the poor singers, they would carve the faces of, say, a disliked prior, or of a stingy cellarer, or something of this kind. And or they would hear, this is where they would put the individuals, partly with demonic and diabolical faces, sometimes recognizable, sometimes not. I know when we did the chapel in the chaplain school, I had a Navy wife doing the drawing. And I had a hard time to keep her from painting the face of James Forrestal on the little serpent that was crawling out of the cup which identified St. John the Evangelist. Because this was just the time when Mr. Forrestal had denied the Navy an aircraft carrier that they were particularly desirous of having. This, or I think of St. James's Roman Catholic Church up in Minneapolis. If you will look at this church, you will find in the window on the liturgical south side, nearest to the west, that is the back end, the apocalyptic dragon over whom Michael is triumphing. This is built in 1934, somewhere along in there. And if you will look at the serpent, you will find that he has a little toothbrush mustache under his nose. Here again, you note the downspout with the... Here you have the same, here again, the way in which he has framed this archway. And the way in which he's carried this up on both sides, and yet you don't have complete symmetry. You'll notice that the window that is built on this side is not as wide as the section is built on here. When you look at it from that end, you begin to appreciate the interest in the design. Again, as you look at that wall, now you have three doors, as you can see. One which has a tympanum over it, one which is more or less squared off, and then you have one there which the door conforms to the axial arch of the doorway. Again, the temptation would be you've designed one door, you've seen one door, you've seen them all, but not as quarter designed. Here, too, you'll notice the three different ways in which he handles the little ornamented corbels at the bottom. Now, here is a shield that should be of some interest to you. What do you make of it? See it right here? Terminating this line which helps to give sweep to this building. What do you make of that shield? Mr. Regner.
Well, I thought I saw a couple letters in it, but...
Well, you're right. This is one of Mr. Carter's little jokes. The design on the shield, which superficially looks as though it should mean something, actually is the initial letter of the last names of the members of the building committee of Concordia Seminary intertwined.
That's right.
Yeah. So here you have a kind of, well, anonymous immortality, if you will.
You know, somebody told me it was in this arch, and
yeah.
I spent a couple of hours looking for some brick in there.
Yeah, well, there you are.
Well, okay.
Now, if you'll step over here to catch this, you have to stand more or less in line. Here again, look at the interesting way in which that barrel vaulting is handled, down to the point where you get to the covering over the entranceway. But also note that it isn't symmetrical, that he carries this wall way over so that it's flush with the column that supports it, with the pillar that supports it, whereas he didn't do it on this side. Again, it isn't the kind of thing that becomes immediately obvious, but as you walk through it, it keeps the archway subtly from becoming something which is just like all the other arches. Each arch has its own little peculiar characteristics, but this is, I think, particularly fine. And then, of course, the admirable and ingenious way in which he handles the flattening of this arch up here, because he wanted to have, he didn't design this doorway, but originally he wanted to have a little rectangle in here. And so he had to flatten that arch, and he did it by running the vaulting in both directions. In other words, it's not just a unidirectional one like this, but it's a crossing.
Does this type of treatment come from the English?
Yes, this is
vault? Is it
this is a development, and it represents the late type of vaulting. Now, here, this tablet is a very nice picture of William Tyndale. I would raise some questions about the propriety of the language here to the memory of the scholar of Luther. Our student disciple, I think, probably would have been better. Translator of the Bible into English. We Lutherans forget that the first three editions of the English Bible were done by Lutherans, either under Luther's personal supervision, as in the case of Tyndale. He did it at Wittenberg, even though the label on the colophon says at Marlborough in the Land of Hesse. This was simply a cover to throw the King of England's spies off. It actually was printed, as it then was believed, by Hans Luft of Wittenberg. The second edition by Taverner was done while he was a minister up in the vicinity of Berlin. And the third, the Coverdale Bible, the Bishop's Bible, was done in large part while he was a pastor at Freiburg, and as English say, Weipont, in the Saargebiet. So that we Lutherans can claim quite a bit of credit for the King James Version. About 70% to 80% of the King James Version, much of which survives into the Revised Standard Version, can be, in a sense, traced to Lutheran translators. Whether one would call him a martyr of Protestantism, possibly in 1525, this is a little bit anticipatory, and I don't think Protestantism is, again, the best term to use because of other meanings nowadays. William Tyndale, this archway, is dedicated by the students of Concordia Seminary of the class of 1924 to 26. And this is one of the handsomest pieces that we have here. And now, as you look here, this was originally, you'll remember, the library, and the idea of Gregor Tower is written. Of course, written first and foremost in the scriptures, as Dr. Pedersen said in his speech at the dedication of the new library, the Christian exegete is a man of one book and a man of many books. And this idea that it is written first of all in the Holy Scriptures, but also that there is a great deal of learning which is ancillary to our study of the scriptures, is suggested by the hand holding the sword of the Spirit, which the Word of God, which cuts asunder to the very separation of the bone and marrow, the two-edged sword, all of this idea. Now, the interest of this archway is enhanced when you look at it from this end. You notice a little offset. You notice then it is off-center, both with reference to this arch as well as to this arch. Now, you notice how he turns himself around. Here, he ran the thing flush with the pillar and extended the pillar out on this side. There, he simply abolishes at the far end. He abolishes the pillar altogether. And he has a pillar only on one side, and the thrust is carried by the stone wall. Here, you have another device of emphasizing by concealment, which is a, girls know this, but it's also a very useful architectural idea. If you want to focus attention on something, just conceal it a little bit. You have here, if you step underneath and look up, the phoenix, the mythological bird which once every 500 years returns to its home in Egypt and puts together a wood and other flammable material and sets it on fire and burns itself up and arises from the flames refreshed and with a new access of youth. Similarly, the church, although it is very frequently apparently reduced to impotence, always rises from its powerlessness to new power. And on this side, you have, this is one of these that always has, it's a, you notice that you have a mythological demon who is transfixed by a pin. And the idea behind this is that it is possible, that it is possible in this way to destroy the forces of evil if you simply bring the matters out in truth. Let me give you the precise background of this one here. Now, I don't see the description at the moment. But there's the general idea behind it, that it is a demon, symbolized by this somewhat saurian-like half-bird, half-animal, transfixed by the pen as the symbol of truth-telling writing. Well, let's walk along this side, and then we'll come back on the other side afterward. You will notice that sometimes he begins his windows at the bottom and stops them partly up. On other occasions, he'll start them. We saw on the other side, you have a different type of example here, partway on the way up and carries them way up to the point of the roof. Again, a little modification. Now, when you come to the Kramer Tower here, you have to kind of angle around in order to see the features. On the east side, what do you see up there at the water spout?
Star on the shield.
Yes.
The wise man type star.
The wise man type star. On which side of the tower is it?
East.
On the east side. So this would be toward the morning.
Yes, yes.
And this is the morning star of the Reformation. These three, you'll see the other two presently, are in the late Lutheran tradition of the pre-reformers. Actually, this is John Wycliffe, you see, who was not very highly thought of by Luther or his contemporaries. The two references to Wycliffe and the Lollards and the Lutheran symbols say that they were just plumb crazy, plane for robot. And the only time that Luther had anything good to say about Wycliffe was a commendation of a commentary on the Apocalypse by one of Wycliffe's chaplains, which was written anonymously, so that he didn't realize that it had come from Wycliffe. I think today we probably hold him in higher esteem. We know that the man whom Luther prized so very highly, John Huss, got practically all of his theological ideas from John Wycliffe. But at least there he is up there. Now, on the south face, you have two other stones. Let's see if you can tell me what you see here.
1498.
And what do you have?
A skull.
A skull, yeah.
And a book.
And a book. 1498, ring any bells? This is the year when, in the city of Florence, an individual by the name of Girolamo, whose last name was Savonarola, was burnt to death. He also, because of his insistence upon virtue and his opposition to luxury, his stress on apostolic simplicity, is regarded as a kind of, precursor of certain emphases of the Reformation. It is regarded in Roman Catholic circles as not unlikely that he may yet be beatified and grace the honors of the altar. And then what do you see on this other one here? 1415. Mm-hmm. And what do you see in the shield itself?
Is that a burning stake?
It's a burning, something is burning there, and what is it?
A fish.
No.
It's a cultural
try a different part of the animal kingdom.
Goose.
And what is goose in Czech?
Oh, it's got to be Huss.
Yeah, it is. Well, this is John Huss. Remember, he was burnt at the stake by decision of the Council of Constance, and the man who was the prosecuting attorney was the individual who probably is quoted more frequently than any other medieval figure in the Lutheran symbols, Jean Le Charrier de Gerson, Chancellor of the University of Paris. Very interesting that these two should be bracketed together. It illustrates that there is room in the church for such honest differences of opinion that one man may actually want to accomplish the execution of another for heresy. Of course, one can say that what was happening was simply that Jean Le Charrier de Gerson was doing his duty as Chancellor of the University. The Cramer Tower, of course, was our high point until the Luther Tower began to go up. A very nice little dormer window there. And in here, you have a relatively modest little memorial, but one that is of interest. We have relatively few busts of this kind. There is one over in Pieper Hall, and there is this one here dedicated to the memory of Augustus Lawrence Grebner. This was the father of the Theodore Grebner, who was here for so very many years, editor of the Lutheran Witness, and probably, in his own person, one of the most influential members of Concordia Seminary. His father deserves a considerable amount of credit that he doesn't always get because he is in that middle generation, died in 1904. Not only did he do a, for its time, very good so-called doctrinal theology, in which he would set up the basic thesis and then would furnish, by means of little keyed lowercase letters, the applicable Bible passages that supported it. It later on was the subject of the dogmatic lectures of W.H.T. Dow. But he was one of the first who really recognized the significance and the importance of English. He perfected himself in English and wrote a really an admirable English style, which in many ways is probably freer of Germanisms than some of the English that is being written by Missouri Synod Lutherans today. And he has contributed very, very greatly to our theological literature. His history was particularly important as a church historian, and his history of early American Lutheranism is still very highly appreciated. But he was one of these men who, like a lot of the professors of the other day, was really a polymath. He was at home in all of the theological disciplines. Please. Another nice little doorway here. And here are two of the birds that I've always enjoyed most. The eagle over on this side and the pelican over on this side. Again, he could have had two eagles. Very frequently he uses the same theme on both sides. But in this case he chose to make one a pelican. This was before Yaroslav Yan Jr. came to the faculty. And he chose to make one what seems to be an eagle. And up here, this again is not the best heraldic technique to put a Bible reference underneath, but you have here the Lamb with a banner of victory. Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. I think it's rather interesting that they use the banner of victory on this particular occasion. Probably more accurately than they realize, it ties together the great atoning events of Good Friday, the Lamb, and of Easter, the banner of victory. And this might serve as a little reminder to us that what God has signed together in our redemptive, our Savior's redemptive work, we ought not to put asunder and try to talk about Good Friday as though it were separable from Easter, or Easter as if it were separable from Good Friday. Well, we come to the third of our archways, and you'll notice that here again we have a different treatment of the arch. By means of this, we saw some beams over on the other side, but the arch was relatively narrow. Here, the beams are carried all the way along. A rather handsome piece of woodwork. Here again, you note his cheerful willingness to put something off-center and to avoid a completely stereotyped symmetry. But here again, now the symmetry does come in when he's done the same trick on each side. That is to say, he has carried the, practically eliminated the pillar. It just sticks out a little bit. It's nothing more than a pilaster. Whereas here it is a full-fledged one. This is the one, of course, that I personally appreciate because I'm a Swede by marriage. My wife is of Swedish extraction, so two of my daughters apparently must be Swedish since I have four daughters. I don't know which two, however. this is archway is dedicated to the memory of Gustavus Adolphus, King of Sweden, who in a very real sense can be called a martyr of the Lutheran Reformation. He gave his life at the Battle of Lisbon in 1632, that the Lutheran Reformation might live. And here you have the scene that is reported by a number of contemporary historians of the Battle of Lisbon before they entered into battle. The king himself led the entire Swedish army in prayer. And down here you have the coat of arms of the house of Vasa, of which he was probably the most illustrious scion. And then you have in Swedish here, Fortheras A. de Lillehoop, be not afraid, O little heap, O little flock, as we have it in English translation. This hymn, which has even been ascribed to Gustavus Adolphus, but is probably the work of one of his military chaplains, I have to get that plug in too as a military chaplain, Fabricius, is very, very popular in Sweden and was actually sung at the Battle of Lützen. I am also very happy that my father-in-law wrote a very fine tune, which is in the Swedish American Lutheran hymnal, for Be Not Afraid, O Little Flock, and he named it after his wife, Agatha. So the name of that tune is tied into our family, too. Yes, sir.
I don't know if I'm just wondering if I haven't heard
it. He is one of the scions of that Lange family, and if I can give you the story on him in just a moment.